Motherhood and Family Planning. Welcome. It's another look into the life and message of Elizabeth Elliot, who called us to live to a higher standard, not satisfied with just a little empty religion in life. As our series continues in the coming weeks, we'll hear from family, friends, and others, all influenced by the life of Elizabeth Elliot and the message that she presented. Hey, thanks for joining us, whether you come with us often or perhaps for the first time. Well, let's take a look at what we can expect. We're wrapping up the series, the 17-part series, The Call to Motherhood, as once again we hear from Valerie and Elizabeth, and a question and answer session later that deals with things such as submission, family planning, divorce, and more. Well, as we've been thinking about family, maybe we should go back and think about Elizabeth when she lost her husband. Now, when she first heard that he was missing, not necessarily that he had been killed, what verse came to mind? Think about that with us. And John Hansen, who takes care of our music here at our time together, he'll talk about what comes to mind when he thinks about Elizabeth. Right now, though, part 17 of The Call to Motherhood. Gateway to Joy host Jan Anderson Wismer gets our discussion started. Valerie Elliott Shepherd, Elizabeth's daughter, will talk about how her experiences in Ecuador affected her expectations, even of giving birth.
During that first pastorate in New Orleans, son number one came along.
That's right.
Tell us about that. A lot of changes come with a new baby and early in a marriage.
Walter was born exactly a year and 2 weeks after we were married. We were married on May 1st. He was born May 15th of the next year. I think another lesson in my growth came when he was born, because my growth in grace. Because I had expected the labor and delivery to be very easy, because I had lived with Indians in Ecuador who had babies all the time and got up and worked the next day. And I don't remember any fear of labor, because I had seen it happen with the Indian women. So Walt and I had gone to Lamaze classes, and I was just very blasé about the whole thing, that it was going to be a breeze. Well, the shock was that it wasn't a breeze, that labor was very hard and very long. And during labor, of course, as you get closer and closer to the delivery itself, they say most women go through a period of time where they say they're just not going to make it, and that they're going to die, or the baby's never going to come. And I did go through that, and it was a real, I was fearful, and I could not believe it was so hard. And my mother and Walt had to be with me during the labor. They had to help me with the breathing, and they had to press on my back, and it was a very difficult labor. And I remember when the baby finally came, of course, the relief and the joy of having a son, but the Lord teaching me through all of that, that I needed his strength, that I couldn't do things in my own strength, and of course I couldn't have made it without the Lord and without my mother's and Walt's help, but that was a big lesson.
Elizabeth, what are your recollections about that birth?
Well, it was an overwhelming experience for me. It's one thing to have a baby, it's another thing to watch your daughter have a baby. I was not, of course, in the delivery room, but I was in the labor room, and so went through every minute of that agony with her. What I remember most vividly was the day that she came home from the hospital with little Walter, and that was the day that Walt, the father, decided that they would start family devotions. And so we were sitting at the breakfast table, and it goes without saying that the baby chose that moment to shriek and scream. And Valerie was sitting there doing her very best to calm him, and she herself was remaining very calm. And Walt would start to read, and the baby would scream, and Val would calm him down, and he'd read another verse, and the baby would scream, and Walt just slammed the Bible shut, just threw it across the dining room table, jumped out of his chair and said, "Forget it. There's no way you can have family devotions with a baby." He said, "We have to wait till he's 10 years old or something." I've forgotten exactly what he did say, but it was chaos. And of course, Val wanted to cry. I wanted to cry. Little Walter was crying, and Big Walter was angry. And I was glad that I was there because after the storm passed, I was able to remind Walt that no family has ever had family devotions in total peace and with the perfect attention of the children that are there. And I grew up in a family where we had a span of 16 years between the oldest and the youngest. So there was always a little child that had to be catered to. And my father took the view that it was at least as important to feed his children spiritual food as it was to feed them physical food. And any mother knows that she goes through all sorts of agonies teaching her children to eat properly, whether it's a new nursing baby or whether it's feeding the baby the first spoonfuls of applesauce or whatever. There are going to be problems. So if you wait for a convenient time to start family devotions, it will never happen.
Valerie, you always wanted to be a mama, as you said on the tape when you were just 4 years old. But in this day and age, a mama of six children, how did you come to that conclusion? And maybe more, I don't know, but you do have six now and a wonderful family. I saw a little article on your counter. I didn't read it all. It said something about what about large families in this day and age. Would you address that issue for us?
Well, I can say that from the time I was tiny, from that radio program when I said I just want to be a mommy, that I always did want to have a large family, probably because of the example of my mother's family. She said there were six in her family, and I got to know my grandmother in high school. Of course, I knew her earlier than that, but began to talk to her about what it was like to raise a large family, and I remember lots of different discussions about teaching the children to obey and disciplining them and not giving in to their whims and all their little desires. And so I always remember saying I wanted to have at least five or six or seven children. And so the Lord has given me my desire, and I'm very thankful. With each one, I have had to recognize during the pregnancy with a couple of them, I was shocked and disappointed that I was pregnant so soon after the other one, but they're all about 2 years apart. I know that some mothers have them closer together than that. But with a couple of pregnancies, I had to go through a time of praying and asking the Lord to help me to accept this gift from Him, because I just felt they were so close together and how was I going to manage? And He would, of course, give me that peace that He knew exactly what I needed at what time. And with each one, we've been so thankful with the wonderful gift that each one is. And we still have not made a definite decision not to have any more. We feel like God knows best what we need and what we should have. As far as our own human limitations, we would definitely say we couldn't handle any more. But then with each one, I've said that, you know, and I've said, but the Lord knows, He can give me the strength at the time that I need it. And a lot of times I've thought I don't have the wisdom for any more. You know, I can barely handle the six that I have, what each different one has different kinds of needs and how to answer their questions. But I believe, too, that through their whole lifetime, God is giving me wisdom. Not that I can say specifically, well, God told me exactly what to say then, but because I keep trusting them into the Lord's hands and keep asking Him for the wisdom and the strength for each day, I believe He's giving it to me.
What is your response to young couples today who say, we don't have the resources, and look at the threat of nuclear war, and look at all the things happening in our world today. This is no time to be bringing children into the world. What is your answer to that argument?
Well, first of all, the resources, I believe absolutely that God provides for His children, and the way society is and the way everything is so bad, and a lot of people say, well, I couldn't bring children into a world that's so bad where no other children are being brought up the same way. I would say if God gives you a child, He will give you the resources and the wisdom, whatever you need for that child.
Do you remember what your grandmother Howard used to say about mm-hmm. when people would say,
How do you have time? Yeah. The grandma who had six children, she said, one does take all of your time, so six can't take any more.
That's good.
And it was true. When I had one child, it seemed like I did everything for him all day long. Of course, the more you have, the less time you have to give individually to each one. The less time you have to give and the less time you have to give, because it seems like there's more love to go around with each one the more you have.
What's a typical day like? Can you take us through a day as typically as you can think of?
I have a baby right now that's about 12 weeks old, and I nurse her anywhere from 5 in the morning till 6:30 in the morning when she wakes up. And so during that time, I nurse her first, then I get up and get dressed, and I try to have devotions, which are often these days interrupted by my 2-year-old, who comes in about 6 o'clock, 6:15, and I like to get her dressed as soon as possible, because by 7:15, my husband and I really have just started trying to get our children up at 7:15. They're not the kind of kids that get up at 6, except for the 2-year-old. I hear a lot of families have that kind. But anyway, our children sleep in until we wake them up. So at 7:15, we wake up the rest of the family. We want Walter and Elizabeth and Christiana to read their Bibles before they come down to breakfast. So we're getting them, trying to get them into that habit. It doesn't work every morning, but that's our goal. We try to have breakfast at 7:30, so usually by 7:15 or so, I'm down in the kitchen. Then after breakfast, they have their chores. We have a chore chart on the refrigerator, and I try to remember to tell them to look at their chart and see what their chore is for the day, and they have to go up and make sure their rooms are cleaned up and their beds made and their teeth brushed. And I'm doing all kinds of different things, whether it's with the baby or with the baby usually sleeps till about 9. With Colleen, getting her dressed, getting my bed made, getting Colleen's bed made, putting the wash in, making sure the kitchen is cleaned up with whoever is helping me that morning. And then around 9:15, we start school. This is homeschool. I teach Walter 6th grade, Elizabeth 4th grade, and Christiana is 1st grade. And what I've been doing is doing the lesson plans 1 week ahead of time, 1 week at a time, so I write down everything for that week. And if I have to be with the baby upstairs, then I just tell Walter and Elizabeth and Christiana to look at the lesson plan for the day and start on their work on their own. It used to be in Laurel that I always started with everybody together, and we'd read some of the Bible together, and we'd pray together to start the school right. Since this baby, I haven't been able to do that, but I've just started this past week trying to do that again, get everybody together and have a Bible reading. And then they go to their different schoolwork.
The Call to Motherhood, Part 17. A question and answer session coming a little later as we think about divorce, submission, and more. Right now, we've been thinking about family. What was it that came to mind when Elizabeth first heard that Jim was missing? We'll start out with a recap of Operation Alka and the 5 men who died.
Just for those who are not acquainted with the massacre that I'm talking about, it occurred in 1956 in the jungle of Ecuador, South America. There were 5 American missionaries who attempted to take the gospel to a tribe of Indians who were then called Aucas, A-U-C-A. They are now called Waurani. They were Stone Age people. They thought that the white men were cannibals, and they slew all of them. They killed them with spears. And one of those 5 was my husband, Jim Elliott. When Jim was killed, the first thing that came to my mind when I got word of his being missing, we didn't know yet whether they were dead or alive, was God's word from Isaiah 43:2, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned, neither will the flame kindle upon you, for I am the Lord your God. And I can testify, after all these 40 years, that God was faithful to his promise. He did not let the waters overflow, and he has been faithful every minute of every day since.
All right, well, later on we'll hear from John Hansen, John provides the music for our time together. He'll have some thoughts on godly wisdom and doing the next thing a little bit later. Right now, a question and answer session dealing with topics such as divorce, family planning, and submission.
Have you a word of encouragement for women who have chosen to stay home and raise their child or children? Since I have made such a decision, even though I feel a great peace about it, occasionally I get discouraged by the battering I get from the media and society in general. My word of encouragement is the older women are to teach the younger women to stay home and to be mothers of children, loving mothers of children. Here I stand, an older woman. Let me give you all the encouragement I can possibly give you by reminding you that that is what God's word says, so you can be sure that you're doing the right thing. You are not doing the popular thing. And you need not defend your position to anybody. God knows your reasons, and God will reward you. I know exactly what you're talking about. I hear it everywhere I go. I do everything I can on my radio program to encourage women. My daughter has gotten plenty of flack, not only because she stays home and takes care of her children, but also because she homeschools her children. She's put in a category of sort of slightly weird people that do that. And the fact that she has six children. People criticize her for that. In light of your view of a Christian couple's obligation to accept children from God, what is your feeling about birth control? I knew that would come. Should we leave the number of children completely up to God? I agree that children are an inheritance from the Lord, but how much should we as Christians try to control? I can't answer that question, and I cannot possibly get into the number of children or when. I think it's very dangerous, just from a purely physiological point of view, to try to postpone the bearing of children for an unreasonable length of time, several years. Couples often get married sooner than I think they should, because they're not ready to take care of themselves. They don't have a house, they don't have jobs. And so I would say, don't get married so soon. If you need to postpone childbearing until your husband has finished medical school or something, then don't get married. But the number of children you have, I'm not going to stand up here and say you have to have all the children that it's biologically possible to produce. I will say this, and I think this is a very important point, that I did not know anything about. It never crossed my mind back in my childbearing years. But there is a big difference between the mechanical and chemical means of birth control and natural family planning. A big difference in principle, I think. And that is that when you are using the mechanical and the medical means, number one, it does not require the cooperation of both spouses. And number two, you are the arbiter. Whereas if you're using natural family planning, it requires love and sacrifice and sensitivity and understanding and cooperation on the part of both spouses. And you are the minister rather than the arbiter. And by this I mean that you are taking something which God built into the reproductive system and making what I would see as responsible and legitimate use of that. To me, that makes a big difference, and I think it's worth considering. I realize this is a marriage and a family conference, but could you pass on just a few morsels of advice for the single person? For example, trusting God for his perfect timing and will in a world where being single is looked down upon. Thank you. Waiting isn't easy, even knowing God knows best and has the best planned. The principles that I've been talking about here apply to all of us, married or single, and they applied to me, widowed or married. The principle of total surrender to Jesus Christ. And I don't know any more severe and tough testing ground than the area of the love life. It's there or nowhere, I think, that we will know whether Jesus Christ is really Lord. Do you believe his promise? No good thing will he withhold from them that walk uprightly. That's Psalm 84:11. If you believe that, then you know what your responsibility is, to walk uprightly, to surrender your desires to him, and to just go on doing what you know God has given you to do. if marriage is a good thing for you, and only God knows if it's good for you, then you have his promise that he will not withhold it. I know the agonies. I have been single most of my life. And I was single up until I was 26 years old the first time, and what I wrote about in my book, Passion and Purity, is exactly the answer to this question. What did I do with all those unfulfilled longings and those desires? I had no way of knowing that I was ever going to marry Jim Elliot. People have said to me, oh, well, it's easy for you to write all that stuff because you finally married him. I was writing about the agonies that I went through long before I knew that God was ever going to give him to me as a husband. What could be done in a situation like this? A Christian married couple where both are working full-time with two kids. The husband has become very controlling and dominates the submissive wife and their kids. He doesn't show any affection or respect for anyone except for himself, and is sometimes close to insulting. He would justify his stance as fulfilling his duty as the leader and head of his family. What can be done when the husband or wife get too far into the leadership or submissiveness? This question would not arise if it were not for a misunderstanding of leadership and submissiveness. We can't get too far into the godly kind. And Jesus makes it very plain that the headship of the husband has nothing to do with bossism or tyranny or cruelty. Jesus himself showed the way. He said, if I, your Lord and Master, wash your feet, you must wash one another's feet. He that would be first among you must be last. He that would be chief among you must be the servant of all. Now that is the godly picture of headship. The father of the family is in a very real and constant sense the servant of all. And that's why it's impossible for him to be out on the golf course for long hours, day after day. He cannot be the servant of his children and his wife when he does that. So I don't know who wrote this question, if it's one of the people in the marriage or if it's an outside observer. But in any case, if it's the wife writing the question, maybe she has a misunderstanding of submissiveness. Maybe she thinks that it means becoming a zero. It doesn't mean becoming a zero. I can't be a help to my husband if I'm a zero. I cannot be a partner in a unity if I'm a zero. One plus one makes two, not one plus zero. So there can be all sorts of gross distortions of the word submissive and the word headship. Are there any reasons or conditions that might possibly give you cause to counsel anyone to get a divorce? The only scriptural reason that I can find is unfaithfulness. And Jesus made it very plain that divorce is only given because of the hardness of your hearts. But if one partner has committed adultery, then that partner has already dissolved the marriage. So the innocent partner in that case is free to leave, according to my understanding of Scripture. It's hard living with an unbeliever. How does the believer draw the line on how much time they spend in Christian activities? And what does one do if the spouse orders the Christian not to go to activities of the church? A Christian needs growth. The answer that I will give will be considered simplistic. But I really believe that because you have a clear-cut command to submit, that's what you do unless you have a clear-cut command that countermands that. Now, the scripture does say to forsake not the assembling of yourselves together. It does not say forsake not the Wednesday night prayer meeting. You must go to church on Sunday night. You must go to church on Sunday morning. You must go to Sunday school. You must go to so-and-so's Bible class. I can't tell you whether or not the command to forsake not the assembling of yourselves together is really one that ought to countermand the other one. But I do believe that when you set yourself to trust God for the results of your obedience, God works miracles. If I had time, I could tell you a long story about exactly this kind of a case that happened to a friend of ours. And she got down on her knees when she found 1 Peter 3 that says that the wife who is married to an unbelieving husband must submit She said when she found that verse, she rushed to the library, got out all the translations she could find, hoping for an escape clause. And all the rest of the translations made it even more plain than it was in the one she'd been reading. And she said, I cried for 2 months because her husband was forbidding her children to go to church. And finally, she said, I got down on my knees and I just opened my Bible to 1 Peter 3 and I pointed at it and I said, all right, God, you said it, I'm going to do it, and my children are going to go to hell and it's going to be your fault. Well, the results amazed her. So the safest thing is always to obey in faith what you believe God has clearly stated that you are to do. And you're not very likely to win your unbelieving husband as long as you are going against his wishes about something like that. But I really do believe that 1 Peter 3 is the passage. You may win your husband, Peter says, without a word being spoken, by the gentle and quiet spirit.
Well, before we go and hear more of John Hansen's music as we close out our time together, let's hear from musician John. Now, John, what is it that comes to mind when you think about Elizabeth Elliot?
Wisdom. And even through being reintroduced to this project through doing the music and things, I was just really blessed with being able to listen to some of her talks and just realize, re-realize how relevant what she was saying is, even, you know, today. And so God really used her in a kind of transcendent way, I'd say. And that's awesome. I think that's kind of was the way that she operated her life, though, and wanted, and other people got to kind of drink from that well, per se, because she just wanted to follow Jesus every day. One of my favorite quotes or things that she said is, do the next thing. For the place that I'm at right now, I believe that God is calling my family to be missionaries to Japan. That's really been a helpful and motivating thing for me. I even have it on my phone. As I open up my phone, it says, do the next thing. It just reminds me that God is in the present and he's just with us, even when it seems mundane or it just seems like things are just, you know, whatever.
Musician John Hansen will be hearing his closing music as normal in just a little bit. But let me take this opportunity to invite you to visit us over at our elizabethelliott.org website. More lectures, talks, devotionals, videos, Gateway to Joy programs, and other resources. Hey, thanks for letting us come along with you. Maybe as you took a walk, maybe driving across town or at home in the office, wherever we found you today. On behalf of the Elizabeth Elliot Foundation, in cooperation with the Bible Broadcasting Network, thanks for joining us once again today. And if you get a chance, leave a review for us at the place you found this podcast. Thanks. Well, until next time, may God remind you each and every day that you are loved with an everlasting love. Underneath are what? That's right. Underneath are the everlasting arms.